This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone, and we are broadcasting today from WGBH's studio at the Boston Public Library. It's just a block from Copley Square, where several hundred people gathered Sunday afternoon to protest in support of science. It's also just a few blocks from where the world's largest general science organization is wrapping up its annual meeting. Thousands of scientists have spent the past 4 days there discussing the role of science in politics and society. Later this hour, we'll talk with students who spoke at this weekend's rally, and also a Tufts professor helping organize high-level science advisors from around the globe to cement the position of science in governance. But first, for one example of where science and policy are meeting right now, intensely, take the prospect of genetically modifying humans. We already have gene therapy, but new tools are enabling scientists to change our DNA in new and amazing and potentially horrifying ways. Last week, the National Academy of Sciences released a new set of guidelines for human genome editing. Richard Hines was co-chair of the expert panel that produced that report. He's an investigator at Howard Hughes Medical Institute and also the Daniel K. Ludwig Professor for Cancer Research at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Richard, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And also with me, Dietram Scheufele. He is John E. Ross Professor in Science Communication and VLIS Distinguished Achievement Professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome to Living Lab.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Dietram, we now have multiple tools, techniques for modifying an individual's genome. Without going into all the technical details, what kinds of modifications are possible at this point?
I think it's probably a question that Richard is a better positioned to answer than myself, but I think the important part to think about is what reactions are we expecting from the public to some of those new possibilities of gene editing? Some of those new possibilities that people have heard about in television shows, if that's Orphan Black, that they've seen in movies and so on and so forth. And so I think it at this point, we're not talking about what's possible, but what may be politically at some point problematic down the road.
Richard, what kinds of things are scientists currently doing and capable of doing in the realm of genome editing in humans?
There are really two categories of things. There is a lot of basic science done in the laboratory that has major impact on human health. Things you can do with these genome editing techniques allow one to, for instance, generate stem cell models of human disease, which one can then investigate in the laboratory, find out what's wrong with those diseases, and find ways of treating them, all in culture, without putting them in people. So that's basic laboratory research, which has a big impact on human development, fertility, for example, and disease. The second category that's underway now, fairly early days, is the use of, you mentioned gene therapy. This is a new development of gene therapy because the tools are much better, easier, faster, cheaper, and more precise. And so they can be used to modify the genome of cells that are defective for one reason or another, usually genetically altered. And if one takes cells from a patient who has such a genetic disease, let's say a blood disease, takes the cells out, engineers them in culture, and then puts them back in again, that has the potential to cure those diseases in those patients. You can replace cells that have a variant that doesn't work well, let's say sickle cell anemia, and you can replace it with a normal gene that's present in the population. So you're not making anything novel or new, you're fixing something that's not working well. And there is a whole panel of diseases like that where a single gene is responsible for the disease and you can fix it. And that's being used now. It's in clinical trials and will increase a lot over the next few years.
So bottom line, what did the National Academy panel decide are acceptable uses of this technology? And what, if anything, did the panel think should be ruled out as ways that we could use this? Because, of course, that's the way that it's being used now, is to treat disease.
That's right.
But there's a whole range of ways that you could apply this technology.
So we said, and the evidence is there, that those two things which I mentioned are well regulated and should proceed. However, you could use similar techniques to make alterations in people, for instance, to make them stronger. And we call that enhancement. Anything that makes somebody more capable in some arena or other than they would normally be. And we said that should not happen at this point, and it should be constrained by the regulations, and there should be a long, detailed public discussion of what sorts of enhancements one might accept. But right now, none. That's one thing. The second thing is the possibility of editing the what's called the germline, the heritable cells, so that if a child would be born with a genetically inherited disease from the parents, it is in principle possible, although not yet practically possible, to make an edit in the genome of the gametes, the sperm or the eggs, or possibly in the embryo, probably more likely the gametes. We can't do that yet, but it has the potential to ensure that those children don't inherit that disease. So I don't think that's going to happen for a number of years, and we said, similarly, one should take up the opportunity of the time we now have before that's feasible, before we really have to decide whether or not to do it, to engage public discussion and discuss whether what the society believes should be allowed.
Dietram, there was actually an international summit just over a year ago that came to a rather different set of conclusions and actually said that more broadly, we should be holding off until we can be sure, first of all, that these techniques are safe and effective. And what Richard's been saying is essentially there are some that currently we think are safe and effective. We've kind of reached that, from a scientific perspective, that threshold of thinking that at least the non-heritable changes are safe and effective. But then they also said until there's broad public consensus, and Richard's been mentioning kind of in a future tense, the idea of engaging the public. I mean, how did we go from hold off until we have broad public consensus to here's what we think we should do, but we should still engage the public in the future? Are we ever going to get around to that public engagement?
So the two fit together really well. The summit basically said, we need a process to work through these things. And one of the very first steps in that process was the committee that both Richard and I were part of, a committee that included representatives from China, from the Chinese Academy of Sciences, from the Royal Society in the UK, from Germany, from Israel, from all parts of the world, that spent 14 months working through exactly some of the questions and some of the cautionary notes that maybe the summary statement from the summit kind of outlined in their statement. But what we're also seeing in the report is that A, we will need engagement for some of those public engagement and broad debates, really, not just about the technical risks, not just about what scientifically may be of concern, such as off-target effects or other things, but also what societal, what political, what ethical concerns may come up that have that are largely unrelated to some of the scientific, or that don't have scientific answers. And we're also saying those should be built in any process, any regulatory process. And there are, to some degree, already the recombinant DNA Advisory Committee, for instance, that approves some of the clinical trials, already has that built in. And in our report, there's some very concrete recommendations for doing that even more formally and maybe build additional competencies and capacities around that. So I don't think we're talking future sense. I think we're talking present tense. And in many ways, I think, where it might seem like a contradiction between the summit statement and us, I think ours is just the first step in exactly what the summit called for.
I mean, the one thing in this new National Academies report where, as you were saying, Richard, there's, some we're not there yet, is this, as you call it, germline modification, heritable modification. And that has, at least in the past, potentially been seen as more of a no-go area because it's heritable, because it wouldn't just be modifying an individual, it would essentially be modifying an entire family line. And yet, some folks at the conference this weekend were basically saying, when the rubber hits the road and you've got a child with a disease, that in some cases the only way to address that would be to modify in a heritable way. You couldn't just do it for that one individual. That all of the moral high ground about we shouldn't modify entire family lines disappears. So is the line here between heritable and non-heritable modification really just a kind of a logistical, technical safety issue at this point, that we will do it at some point when it's safe and effective? Or do you think there is still some sort of ethical line between non-heritable and heritable changes?
We laid out a whole series of criteria that would have to be met and might not be possible to meet, certainly for individual cases. We laid out a long list of criteria that would have to be met before such a thing could be considered for a clinical trial. And right now, we can't do it. So this is still in the future that one would... So we're saying the same thing as the summit said. They said one should continue to work on this research and one should discuss the ethical societal issues. And we're laying out the ways to do that. So it was a continuation of what the initiative was initiated to do, which was to have the summit and then proceed with a series of further discussions.
Inheritable changes.
We laid out a whole series of criteria that would have to be met and might not be possible to meet.
So still a difference. There are more complications, ethical and otherwise, about heritable germline editing than there are about somatic editing, which is not heritable. So the summit also said that the somatic editing was good to go, and we just elaborated more detail on what needed to be done to make sure it was done right. So there's a difference, definitely. There are more implications of the heritable genome editing.
In case you're just joining us, my guests are Richard Hines of MIT and Dietram Scheufele of University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dietram, it seems like in a lot of cases the real concern, and perhaps I'm betraying my own bias here, but it seems like if you look at history, if there's a technique that's going to enable us to address a disease, it can remain controversial, but at some point it's basically going to become accepted. The real issue here is this idea of designer babies, of cosmetic or aesthetic alterations, enhancements. Is there really, though, any way, once we start down this path of drawing a hard red line between what's fixing a disease and what's enhancement? I mean, we already have these debates just with drugs. Is Viagra treating a disease or is it a personal enhancement? So how are we going to address that when it comes to genome editing?
Sure. And what you outline is a concern that I think we as a committee heard from a lot of sides, and that is the idea of a slippery slope, right? Once we get on it, we're going to slide down no matter what happens. And I think what's really important is also it was reflected in your last question about, you know, is there a moral line that we're crossing? And the answer to that question is can only be a societal or political one. It's one that we as a society and actually as a global society need to discuss, given how easy it is to do in many ways modifications with CRISPR-Cas9. This is why we're having this discussion, this urgent discussion now in the first place. But basically where the answer of what those moral lines are will have to be societal discussions. Now, the report draws some very clear lines between therapy and enhancement, and I think that's a useful distinction. But as we go ahead and as applications become available, this is a discussion that we'll have to have continuously, but then also for every single case. And we need to have the infrastructure in place, and the report says that very explicitly. And it's a new way of thinking about science, right? It's a new way of thinking about technologies really emerging at the same time that the societal discourse surrounding them emerges. And we're trying to make sense what that means for us ethically. If we think we are crossing lines we don't want to cross, how we weigh the needs of parents and of children who may have a disease that can only be cured with particular gene editing techniques, and maybe other groups in society that are deeply concerned about editing the human germline, and how we negotiate those and how we do the trade-offs. But that's, I think, one of the things that will only have political and not just scientific answers. That's really the important takeaway from that.
The sense that I get from a lot of scientists is this kind of dilemma between knowing, understanding deeply that this has to be a public discourse, and yet also a very deep-seated fear of opening this up to public discourse and a concern that most of the public may not have the expertise or access to the information necessary to make an informed decision. And in part, this came up at the meeting over the weekend because last week this report came out, lots of headlines everywhere, lots of different headlines. But in particular, you actually and a colleague pointed out that a very respected publication, the MIT Technology Review, came out with a headline that was completely wrong, saying that this panel had just endorsed designer babies. Mm-hmm. What does that say to you about the state of media and public information? How warranted is the fear that we won't have the information necessary to make these decisions well?
I think it says two things. I think, one, I think we have a pretty good state of science journalism, continue to have in this country, and I think these... So I wouldn't want to overstate that case. But number two is, I think it highlights really nicely that this is an issue that, that one can look at from very different angles, depending on what one emphasizes. And as I just said, there is, for example, a trade-off between some groups in society who feel very strongly that editing the human germline is a line we should never cross, and there are other groups in society who feel very strongly that curing diseases, if we have the technical skills, is something that we should be doing. And the solution to that conflict will have to be broader debate, and that debate will come with different headlines and different ways of emphasizing. I do think that ultimately the one thing we do want to avoid is getting drawn into a highly polarized, sometimes, battle over some of these new technologies. And by polarized, I mean politically polarized. That's what science should stay away from, because otherwise that debate is not going to be a productive one.
And yet this report, right, doesn't just say, scientifically, here's what's safe and effective, now you decide what's ethical. Already the science community in this realm is weighing in on what might be considered ethical, what the science community considers ethical at this point. Is that already crossing that political line?
I'm not sure if we're saying what's ethical. I think we're saying this is what we think is safe from a scientific perspective, and we think that there are processes and regulatory processes in place that will allow us to have those debates within the recombinant advisory DNA advisory committee, within other bodies. So I don't think we're making a statement on the ethics, but we're rather saying there are mechanisms in place for debating the ethics, the moral, the politics, for some of those issues, and for others we need to have those emerge along with the science.
That's Dietram Scheufele of University of Wisconsin-Madison, also Richard Hines of MIT. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Heather Goldstone. Up next, science students speaking out on current politics. That's when Living Lab continues after a short break.